unmet need for contraception among HIV service clients. And our speaker is Dr. Elizabeth Oliveras, who's a senior research and metrics advisor at Pathfinder International, where she supports monitoring, evaluation, and research for health projects in Africa. Prior to joining Pathfinder, she worked at the ICDDRB in Bangladesh for years. And doesn't say how many, 4 years. And she has worked in the field of international reproductive health for more than 18 years. She has a master's and doctorate from the Harvard School of Public Health. Elizabeth, please.
Okay, good afternoon. So I'm going to be talking about assessing unmet need for contraception among HIV service clients and how we can increase the efficiency of that process. So it's actually a little bit different than what the title suggests. I have no relationships to disclose. So integration of family planning with HIV services is considered an international best practice. It's promoted by the WHO, and it's actually prong two of their approach to prevention of maternal to child transmission. Integration is designed to promote primary HIV prevention through dual method use or correct and consistent condom use, and to prevent unintended pregnancy and thereby prevent infections in children. And that's done by addressing unmet need for family planning among HIV-positive women. So why is this important in our context, which is northern Uganda? First, Uganda has a high rate of HIV, 6.5% nationally. It's actually higher in the north, where we were working. And there's inadequate access to PMTCT services with less than 50% coverage. And this leads to about 25,000 children who are infected annually. Past studies have shown that among women who are on ART, 86% of those who do not wish to have any more children are not using contraception. So that suggests that they do have high levels of unmet need. So in response to this, Pathfinder implemented an intervention to integrate FP into HIV services in 8 post-conflict districts. The project goal is very consistent with the WHO approach to addressing unmet need for contraception, averting unintended pregnancies, and increasing dual method use. And as part of this study, we're actually looking at the cost effectiveness of FP-HIV integration for preventing HIV infections. We did a baseline survey, and that's what I'll be presenting about today. Our methodology is very standard cross-sectional client interviews. They were conducted last October. We randomly selected 4 of the 8 project districts, and we conducted interviews in 13 facilities. All the women who were visiting for ART or pre-ART services on the days that the interviewers were there were eligible to participate. And they were interviewed by women who were HIV positive in order to sort of increase the feasibility of interviewing them and decrease the stigma. We did obtain approval from ethics committees both at PATH and at Makerere University School of Public Health. These are some women conducting interviews outside to make sure it was somewhat private. Our sample is about 1,200 women, 15 to 49. Actually, those were the women who were women who were approached. Only one woman refused. 3 women did not complete the interview. And we actually included 1,221 women in the analysis because they had complete data. In terms of who we interviewed, the mean age of these women was 33 years. And about 37% of them were not married. And I think it's important to point out that 75% of these unmarried women were over age 35, which suggests that these are women who are widowed, divorced, or separated, and not women who have never been married. Almost 40% were married, and then another quarter were living with a partner. Educational attainment, pretty low overall, with about a quarter having no education at all. And in terms of their time since diagnosis, it was actually about 4 years, but it ranged from less than 1 month to 7 or more years. And a third of the women had been diagnosed more than 5 years before the survey, and I think that's important, as you'll see later. They're sort of long-term HIV-positive women. This is the standard DHS definition of unmet need. I'm not going to go through it unless people have questions about it. But what is important about it is that this is designed to assess unmet need using population-based surveys, and it uses a series of more than 12 questions. And this next slide shows you the DHS algorithm. And I know it's tiny and you can't read it, and I'm really presenting it just to show you that it's a very complicated algorithm. And so to get to what seems like an easy thing, do you need family planning or not, you actually have to go through quite a complicated series of questions. It's not very practical in a clinical setting. So when we actually want to ask women, do you need family planning, and what kind of services do I need to give you as your clinical care provider, we can't go through that complicated process. So the interagency task team on PMTCT and pediatric HIV, which is led by UNFPA, has put together a tool that they're piloting. And so we chose to adopt their tool and to pilot that as well in our own project. It's designed really to be used at the clinical care level, so to screen women for family planning and then to go on to counseling them if they have unmet need. This is actually an abbreviated form, so it would fit on the slide, but it includes all the key questions. So you ask first, are you currently pregnant? If she is, you ask, did you want to become pregnant at the time that you became pregnant? And for those women, you automatically categorize them as having no need or having unmet need for family planning. If they're not pregnant, we go on to ask them, do you want to become pregnant within the next year? And then, if yes, you don't need family planning because you want to become pregnant. And if no, we ask two more questions. Are you currently using a method? If yes, great. You don't have unmet need. If no, we ask you why you're not using. So is it because you're infecund, in which case you don't need family planning because you can't become pregnant, or you're not sexually active? And anyone else is classified as having unmet need. How does this differ from the DHS approach? One is that we're really filtering women down. And so DHS asks these questions separately. We don't exclude people from any of the questions. Well, not completely, but we don't exclude people to the same extent based on existing questions. And it also uses a shorter time frame. So this uses 1 year instead of two. And frankly, I'm not sure why that decision was made, why to use a different definition. So it's something to talk with them about. The other thing is that it specifically asks about sexual activity, or it specifically looks at that as a factor in unmet need. And the DHS approach limits the analysis to married women in most countries. And so they're using marriage as a proxy for sexual activity. And for our population, what I'm going to show you is I think that's not really appropriate. So when we look into our data, and this is using the DHS approach, a little bit modified to make it simpler for our interviewers, this is what we see in terms of unmet need for family planning. So the orange and the blue, here and here, about 17% of women have unmet need for family planning. This was much lower than what we expected based on the past research. And the reason for that is that actually a fair number of women are already using family planning. So 39% of the sample were using family planning already. And other women either wish to become pregnant in the next 2 years, or they were not fecund. So they were either menopausal, or they said that they could not get pregnant. I think the main point, that's for another slide. Okay. So then we looked at this a little bit more detail, and this slide shows a comparison of women who were sexually active in the past year and women who were not sexually active in the past year. And using the DHS approach, they're sort of all lumped together. But when we separate them out, we see that women who were sexually active in the past year actually have even lower unmet need for family planning. So it's about 12%, 13%, compared to 25% among women who are not sexually active. You can question, do sexually active? Women who are not sexually active actually have unmet need for family planning. Yes, they show up as having it, but I don't think they really do. You're not having sex, so you don't need a method. Okay. So then we looked at the correspondence between sexual activity and marital status, if we wanted to use a more DHS-like approach. And 30% of women who are not married are in fact having sex. And that is consistent with everything we sort of know about women. You know, they do have sex when they're not married. So again, sexual activity is probably a better proxy for sexual activity than marriage. Just ask. I'm going to skip over this. It's just a comparison of sexual activity in women who are not married. And we see pretty much the same levels of unmet need for family planning. But what we do see is that women who are not married are more likely to be using family planning, which is great. That's what we want. So what does this mean in terms of the provision of services, which is really what we're trying to get at in this project? What this shows in blue is the sequence of questions as established in the IATT tool, where you ask first about pregnancy, and then you ask about whether you wanted the future pregnancy. The red boxes show what would happen if you switch the order of those questions. So you see that when we ask in the way that's structured now, in the way that it was originally designed, only 8% of the women get excluded after the first question. So 8% of women are pregnant, and you stop asking them after those first two questions on pregnancy. If you started by asking about sexual activity, you would exclude 30% right off the bat after the first question. Why is that important? It's because the providers who are serving HIV-positive women are busy. Activity, you would exclude 30% right off the bat after the first question. 5 short questions when I'm counseling clients, and really what I'm trying to do is provide them with ART or pre-ART. I'm not a family planning provider. You want me to add this to my job. So we need to make it as easy as we can for them. So the next step, if you use the original approach, we've still only excluded 15% of, so we need to make it as easy as we can for them. So the next step, we've excluded 63% of the women with just 2 questions. So it's a much more efficient way at getting at unmet need for family planning. I wanted to look a little bit about, the best order, and I think there's a lot more work to be done on this. So this does the same thing, but just switching the order of the questions. So we ask first about whether or not you're using a method at all, and then we ask why are you not using, which are the last 2 questions in the tool. And what we see here is actually a little bit of an increase in efficiency, with 65% of women excluded after those first 2 questions. So I think there's a need to look at what makes most sense for women, what are providers most comfortable in asking, before we can decide sort of the best way to go about it. But I think this is clear that the way we're doing it now is not the best approach. There are, of course, some limitations. While we said that all women who came for services were eligible, in large clinics there were way too many women for us to interview because the number of interviewers we had, they just couldn't absorb all of the clients in a single day. So there was some selection going on, and I don't think we have a clear sense of how those women were selected. It was basically, for the most part, based on interviewer availability. So an interviewer became free, and the next client that came out was assigned to her. We didn't have women waiting for long periods of time to be interviewed, but there's definitely a potential for bias there. We did use a slightly modified version of the DHS approach, and our end-line survey will include all of the standard DHS questions, so we can compare more specifically the DHS approach to what's happening. Also, just to get a sense, and that's not really what I'm talking about today, but to get a sense of how well do these measures line up. So if we're using a survey, how well does that match with these clinical measures of unmet need for family planning? And we did not assess wantedness of pregnancy, so the data that I presented did not include women who were pregnant as having unmet need or not having unmet need. They're all lumped under pregnant. And I think from a clinical perspective, that makes sense because we're not going to be counseling them in the same way and providing methods to them. Of course, we want to give them information about family planning in the postpartum period, but we don't need to give them the same level of counseling that we would give someone who's not pregnant. So in conclusion, in northern Uganda, a significant proportion of women who are using HIV services are not at risk of pregnancy because they're not sexually active. We're not adequately taking that into account at the moment. Traditional approaches to assessing unmet need may lead to distorted estimates as a result, and may not be efficient for service provision. And I think the screening tools really need to be adapted and tested in more detail. But I think clearly from this, at least, we should start by asking about sexual activity or family planning use, so not with pregnancy. And finally, a better screening tool would really allow providers to focus on clients' needs rather than asking a lot of irrelevant questions. And acknowledgments to the many people who were involved in this study. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was very good. Okay, I'd like to invite the speakers to come forward and we can have some questions and answers until the end of the session. Could you all come forward and... So, there should be enough space for everybody.
No, go ahead and sit down here.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's large panels. Okay. Okay, question? Here's a question.
From the team. Do you happen to know the failure rate when you use metoprolol for incomplete abortion? How many women had to go on to have an MDA, which was apparently what the next step was?
Yeah. Do you want to come up here and
answer? Yeah,
unfortunately, I don't have the number in front of me, but it was in line with the what you see in the literature, which is, you know, about, and Rachel's here, if she remembers, I would say above 90%, so very few.
Above 90%.
Success, not referrals.
I mean, because there's, of course, a failure rate with MDA.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that I noticed that too. I just wanted to focus on the religious aspect. And actually, we have a poster presentation tomorrow that's going to talk a little bit more about the other methods that were used and how we
can. Do
you remember the number?
I'll look it up.
Okay, I'm sure we'll be able to find it.
Okay.
You can let us know by the end of the session what the number is for tomorrow. Okay.
Question for Martine, and again, thanks to everyone for great presentations. Martine, on one technical point, you said you talked about metoprolol being swallowed. I think they're used sublingually, aren't they, to get a higher blood level?
Yeah, both, actually.
The literature, at the time of the project, they were swallowing it, but I think literature came out subsequently.
Oh, well, probably would produce a lower effectiveness rate. The other point, in terms of the pushback from mm-hmm. both clinicians and donors like USAID, mm-hmm. is one, this question about, you know, do you have adequate backup and how are they treated? And mm-hmm. were they treated on site? Were there midwives trained on site for treating those who were still bleeding?
So if mesoprostol did not result in a complete,
right.
No, it depended on the level of facility. So at the
uh-huh.
very low level, health centers without MVA, they would have to be referred to the next level up, but they were providing means for that.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. And the last component is of course, post-abortion family planning is a
mm-hmm.
key part of the services. So what
mm-hmm.
were your results here? And
mm-hmm.
again, it's a different kind of service in terms of performing that vital component
mm-hmm.
for family planning provision and by method.
Unfortunately, I didn't bring the numbers in front of me, so I'm going to have to go from memory. And again, Rachel, if something comes up that you remember. So we basically, as part of the project, reinforced the training that providers received, but were unable to provide the actual commodity of the family planning. We partnered with another organization that was supposed to supply it. So there were the family planning rates, per my memory, we're not as high as we would have liked. I want to say it's in like, it was like the 2/3 to 3/4. Does that seem about right to you, of women receiving family planning? However, I mean, some women, we're also talking about miscarriage, so some women also may have wanted to become pregnant. So we may not never receive 100%. So there were issues of supply that I think inhibited an uptake that we would have liked to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another question?
I have a question, maybe a common question for presenters. So in Rwanda, my question was, in terms of the cards, the outcomes you were measuring, you got the uptake on family planning, and I guess I wanted to get a sense of what types of family planning, because I think at the beginning of the presentation you were talking about the standard days method a lot, but it sounded like from the slide that the clients were more interested in pill
and injectable, and then lower interest in the standard date. And I just wanted to get a sense of what the actual uptake was and what type of family planning. And then I have a question for Alex.
Yeah, I think I need to rephrase it a bit. So we were looking at new family planning users, no matter what method, as our outcome measure. And the SCM, that was sort of our own organizational interest because there wasn't a lot of diffusion, people talking about it as a new method. So we thought this would help that, but we weren't really, our goal wasn't to necessarily increase SDM use, it was just overall.
Okay, and so what methods were the new methods?
It was all the methods that are offered by the ministry, and I don't have that data with me. We want to look at it in terms of, you know, what people ended up using. Because we actually asked people from the family planning registers, you could see what method they went in with, or what they wanted to have, and we could also see what they went out with. But it's just not very sharing it. So it's a good question.
And Alan, it was more of a comment slash question. I thought what was interesting about looking at Egypt versus Iran was it didn't sound like in Iran there was much of a Western presence in terms of kind of promoting it. It seemed like it was more organic coming from the actual government. And I feel like it's one of the tensions in terms of, you know, being here talking about what we need to do in other countries, whereas a successful country, it seems like it was actually kind of driven from within. I mean, where do you see our role as, you know, other organizations coming in and telling people?
Yeah, that's definitely a kind of a catch-22 there. And in Iran, it was, like you said, it was Western-oriented, and they had to come to the realization, and under very, you know, crazy conditions of, you know, very high birth rates and huge population growth, for them to make that shift for the, you know, the conservative religious establishment to suddenly flip the switch and push the other way. And now, actually, right now, they start to push back in opposite direction, and they're starting to say that our population is shrinking, and we need to have a larger population to be a strong Muslim society. And I don't know, it's hard to make it happen in the country, but Yeah, it's 1.7 birth rate in Iran, so that's it's going to shrink in the future. And Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, has repeatedly tried to bring up the issue that we need to increase the birth rate for women. So he's going backwards. It's tough to say how you would manage from the outside going in. And I'm sure there are people in Egypt who feel that way. Maybe if you could facilitate, collaborate, this is probably controversial, but if you facilitated some sort of collaboration between Iran and Egypt on this issue, it would probably work out a little bit better than from the U.S. to Egypt.
Very interesting. Question?
So the information came from exit interviews after the woman had received treatment, and it was the exit interview was administered by a provider that did not offer the woman services. So it wasn't the same provider saying, how to learn how to live. It was not.
Any other comments or any other points that the speakers would like to bring up? Oh, question. Two more questions. Here, one back.
Shifts a lot of the workload away from them, and life becomes easier, and they buy in, even though you know there may have been all these concerns of this isn't the level of quality that brings providing it. And I'm wondering if you'd care to comment on that, if you've seen that or not, or whether that's one.
I completely agree, and actually have experience in not just in Mozambique, but also in Ethiopia, where we're doing comprehensive abortion care and introducing misoprostol in that context as well. And I heard very similar things. I'm not sure if everyone heard, but that there may be some initial reluctance from highest level providers around, you know, a little bit of, you know, infringing on their turf if this is a service that they've been providing and it needs to be provided by someone who's very high level and very technically skilled, with the introduction of this somewhat easier method that, you know, it's taking away from their client base. But what I have seen in my experience is that it's actually a relief to see, you know, such the burden of treating such a high caseload with this being shifted to other providers and freeing them up to use their technical skills that they've really been trained for. So I have seen buy-in from doctors and higher level providers involved.
And then ultimately ministries of health.
Yes, exactly. Ministries of health as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question in the back.
Hi, I'm Jessica. I work with Childhood, and I focus on adolescent sexual reproductive health. So I was wondering in particular for my team, if there are restrictions in the provision of misoprostol to teens or to adolescents on that spectrum, and then as well, do you think you're able to involve adolescents or young adults in community health workers or the part of that invitation network?
Great. So, again, I struggled to remember the ages in the study, but we did have some women under the age of 18. There was no provision against the use of misoprostol in minors, but the proportion of the women presenting it was very small.
It would be a great idea to use you for this invitation card, but we didn't do it. But there's quite a big youth organization. That's something to think of as we think of trying to roll it out at a larger scale.
Another question?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the reasons we need to test it, and I think it will vary by setting as well, and perhaps mm-hmm. by group. So unmarried women may be less willing to admit that, but married, so there are all sorts of things that come into play there, just speaks to the need to mm-hmm. test more in detail.
I have one question for Adrienne, since there doesn't seem to be any. We're coming to the end. Adrienne was talking about the four main messages for healthy space, healthy timing, healthy spacing, and pregnancies, trying to push women into lower risk categories, you know, wait until you're 18 years old, between 18 and 35 years old. So I wanted to know if there's any evidence to date that those communication messages are actually effective in getting mothers to change their behavior and to move into lower risk categories for childbearing.
Our program is still very young, mm-hmm. but we do know that in UP, where they've been using those messages for the last 3 years, the age of marriage has risen from 17.5 to 18.5 mm-hmm. in 3 years. Mm-hmm. So that's really good. Mm-hmm. We're also, let me know, half the births are less than 3 years apart, which was half the better births are more than 3 years apart, which is extremely good. We're getting bigger, better spacing, even though it's still anecdotal, mm-hmm. but we're getting better spacing in light of the fact that most Indian women want to have two or three children, bang, 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 and get it over with, and then get sterilized. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge shift for them mm-hmm. to realize there is a benefit, and they are delaying that second pregnancy. Mm-hmm. In our community.
Okay, so the answer is there is yeah. some evidence. Okay, great. Well, any other questions? If not, then let's have a round of applause for the speakers. And thanks to the speakers, and thank you all for participating in this.